Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone, and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects, and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
Nick Warner served for nearly 50 years as an Australian intelligence officer, diplomat, and defense official. He ran Australia's Secret Intelligence Service for 8 years, and he served for 2 years as his country's first Director General of the Office of National Intelligence. Nick just recently retired from public service, and he and I just sat down to talk about his career. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our exclusive sponsor, Lockheed Martin. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Nick, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It's a real honor for us to have you on the show. Welcome.
Michael, thanks so much. It's really good to talk to you from down here in Australia.
You know, what's interesting is we have a lot of listeners in Australia. In fact, when you look at the country breakdown, we have, after the US, Australia has more listeners than any other country in the world. So you're going to be talking to some of your mates as well here, I think.
Okay, that's really interesting. I guess it shows how important the US is to Australia and to Australia's security and the extraordinarily broad links and deep links between our two countries.
And I think it's a reflection of how many friends I have down there too. So, Nick, you and I have had many conversations over the years, and I think it's great that we're able to share one of those with our listeners. So I would love to start by asking you some questions about you and your background so our listeners can get a sense of who you are. And I'd love to start by asking, what got a young Nick Warner interested in the world and in foreign affairs?
Okay, so Michael, my father was a journalist. He was a freelance foreign correspondent and indeed war correspondent, and wrote a lot for U.S. and U.K. Magazines and newspapers. He followed U.S. forces through the Pacific during World War II with MacArthur, wow, with General MacArthur. From Guadalcanal to Bougainville to Saipan to the Philippines, bombing raids over Tokyo. And then after World War II, he and my mother and my elder sister lived in Japan for a couple of years. So this is immediately after the war. And Dad worked on pretty much, I think, every major conflict from the Korean War through the fall of Dien Bien Phu and the Viet Minh taking over Hanoi, the whole of the Vietnam War. He was there at the end as Saigon fell to the Viet Cong, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kashmir, all of that. And my mother too. You know, she was a journalist and an author. And I spent, I guess, the first 6 years of my life living in Singapore and actually in the US. So my father was away on these assignments probably for 6 months of every year while I was growing up. And so when he would come home, we'd sit around over dinner and in front of the fire during winter and talk about his latest adventures and what was happening in the world. So I think all of that, you know, just sort of got me interested in the world and what was happening and the excitement, I guess, of his life. And then, I mean, this is all a long time ago, Michael, but then in 1969, Australian forces were fighting in Vietnam with US forces. And like you, we had conscription. So in 68, 69, I was, my number came up and I was conscripted and I was to go to Vietnam in a year. Well, I was going to be called up and potentially to go to Vietnam in a year or two. So this is a crazy idea of my father's. He decided that this long-haired, scruffy 19-year-old kid at university should go with him and do a TV documentary, How Did I See the Vietnam War? It was a catastrophe as a TV documentary. I was too young, too naive, just couldn't get my didn't have the confidence to do the interviews. Leaving that aside, it ended in an interesting way. The Australian Army, which had approved all of this, decided at the last minute that they didn't like the idea, and we that is my father and I were basically arrested down on the coast of South Vietnam by the Australian military and spent an uncomfortable 6 hours or so in this camp. So all of that, that trip, that background, the visit, I really liked the buzz. I liked the access. I liked the smell of the place and the adventure. And I guess it's that combination that that really got me going, got me involved. And I guess, look, a final point, Michael. I think there are a lot of similarities between journalism and intelligence. And I thought about the former. I thought about going into journalism, and I chose the latter. A few years ago, I launched a book for an Australian journalist, a guy called Mark Colvin, famous Australian journalist who died tragically a few years later. And Mark asked me to launch his book because his father was an intelligence officer working for MI6. And as I say, he was a journalist. So the sort of opposite of my father and myself.
Yeah.
And in his book, and I was just looking at it again the other day, Mark said this: a spy and a journalist, if they're doing their jobs properly, are both trying to find out the truth behind the lies and the propaganda, even if they use radically different tools. And with the difference, of course, that journalists are trying to meet the largest number of people, get to the largest number of people they can, and we as intelligence officers are always restricted to a pretty small audience.
Fascinating. So, Nick, you started your career in government as an intelligence officer? How did that happen?
Yeah, I did, Michael. So after I left university, I applied for a few jobs. And like most of us, I failed at my first attempts. As I said before, I was long-haired and scruffy in those days. So I applied to get into ACES, Australia's Secret Intelligence Service, and failed. And I tried to get into our Foreign Affairs Department and failed there too. With ACES, the feedback I got was my skill set was more relevant to the analytical side. So my application was then passed on to something called the Joint Intelligence Organization, and I joined that 47 years or so ago, and worked for a couple of years in an office called the Office of Insurgency and Subversion Studies. So there were just a few of us in this office, headed by a chain-smoking half-colonel who'd just come out of Vietnam. It was fun. It was interesting. It taught me the basics of intelligence analysis. And I guess our first job together, this half-colonel and I, was putting together a guide to insurgencies around the world. And that led on to... To 15 years or so of a career of working on Africa.
Nick, I went through your biography the other day, and you also served in addition to your first intelligence assignments and then the intelligence assignments at the end of your career, you served in a long list of diplomatic assignments. Was there a theme to those assignments?
Well, maybe there were a couple of themes. Michael, as I was saying, working on insurgencies and subversion around the world led me to Africa. So on Africa, as both an intelligence analyst and a diplomat, I worked for maybe more than 15 years. And the starting point was the guerrilla wars, the insurgencies that were raging in those days, back in the 70s and early 80s, Guinea-Bissau, Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, Rhodesia, before it became Zimbabwe, and growing conflict in South Africa, and as I say that allowed me really to make the transition from intelligence analyst to diplomat, and then the second theme I guess I had a pretty unusual diplomatic career over a couple of decades, with one exception, and that exception was Iran, and I can come back to that later. All of my overseas postings with our Foreign Affairs Department involved peacekeeping or peacemaking operations. And indeed, much of my time in our Foreign Affairs Department in Canberra revolved around conflicts that were raging around the world and conflict resolution. So, again, in Canberra, I worked on the end of apartheid in South Africa. Worked in the late 90s on East Timor's journey to independence. And then, like you and so many other intelligence officers and diplomats, counterterrorism became a big theme after 9/11. And then, of course, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Syria. So as a diplomat, I served in Australian diplomatic missions way back in Rhodesia when it became Zimbabwe in 1980. We had Australian forces there then. Namibia in the late 1980s during a very big and ultimately very successful UN transition to independence from South Africa. Then a little bit later in Cambodia from 91 to 93 as that country went through UN elections after, you know, the Khmer Rouge and Year Zero. And then a couple more in Papua New Guinea, Australia's nearest neighbour, between 99 and 2003. And there was a big peacekeeping operation for Australia in an island off the main island called Bougainville. And then finally, in the Solomon Islands a few years after that. And as I said before,
that was sort of the pinnacle, right? That was sort of the pinnacle of your peacekeeping efforts. You were the head of the peacekeeping force there. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we described it as a police-led operation. That is, it was law enforcement was the primary function. So we had 10 regional countries involved in this, led by Australia, 300 police. And I think at the peak, we had something like 1,700, 2,000 military involved. And the military that were there to... It was a bit like shock and awe. The military were there to ensure that we didn't have to use the military. And it was, look, it was ultimately highly successful. We didn't fire a shot. We quickly wrapped up the various militia groups that had been operating, terrorizing the country, a very successful weapons disposal process. It was a lot of fun, and yes, it was very successful. And I guess I learned a lot from all those previous peacekeeping operations that served me well at the time.
So you mentioned earlier ambassador to Iran. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I was in Iran as ambassador from 1993 to 1997. Beautiful country. Really wonderfully friendly people, an amazing culture, and it's fair to say that it was my wife's favorite posting anywhere because it was a real country with a real culture, and we traveled a lot. We traveled all over the country, and I guess you know, in a long career, it was certainly one of the highlights. And while it didn't fit within the context of the rest of my career, it nonetheless served me well. Iran was then, and of course remains now, an important regional player and a country of continuing great importance to the United States, even if that importance is not for the best of reasons. So
you got lost in the Iranian desert when you were there, right?
I did. As I say, we traveled a lot around Iran, and I was traveling with a friend one long weekend. And if you can imagine the layout of Iran, and you go east about 170 kilometers, you come to a town called Semnan on the main highway to Mashhad, so big, you know, 4-6 lane highway. So my friend and I decided that we'd get off the highway in our four wheel drive and see what was down in the desert. Wasn't the best decision that either of us ever made. Anyway, we drove for a few hours, and the tarred road turned into a dirt road, which turned into a couple of tracks in the desert. We crossed over a salt-encrusted creek, came to a second one of those salt-encrusted creeks, and decided that why not? We'll give it a go. And we got stuck. So we're stuck in the middle, literally, in the middle of nowhere. My friend tried to walk out for a few hours, came back, hadn't found anybody to help. It was getting dark, and I decided that the embassy, so this, I guess, is, you know, like the end of the weekend, the embassy would be pretty concerned if I didn't turn up for work the next day. So I decided I had to walk out. Instead of walking due north, which would have got me to the main highway, I decided I would head towards what were then the brightest lights in the desert. That was a good decision and a bad decision. A good decision because I eventually got to the source of the brightest lights, and a bad decision because there would have been a shorter, easier, quicker, more successful way to have got help. Anyway, I walked pretty much all night. Eventually got to my destination, the source of the lights, which turned out to be a salt mine, and the salt mine was co-located next to an Air Force base.
And oh, no.
It seems that what I had done was walked across Iran's missile testing range in the middle of the night. So this was both a highlight and a lowlight of my, my career. It led to the expulsion of my friend, and me waking up one morning to a headline: Australian ambassador may be expelled, which, as you can imagine, got my my bosses back in Canberra a little excited. In the end, that didn't happen. And in retrospect, I like it. It's a good story.
It's a great story.
It seemed less good at the time.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Nick Warner.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
So, Nick, then you serve as the Secretary of Defense, which is the senior most career government official in your Ministry of Defense. So there's a politician who sits on top of you, but you're the senior most career official. I think you served in that role from 2006, I think, to 2009. So Afghanistan and Iraq were a central focus. What was that experience like?
Well, obviously, such a senior job was a highlight, Michael, of my career. I got to say, it was probably the toughest job that I've ever done. You know, running a very large workforce with a huge budget, with pretty key capability decisions to be made. I'm not going to say it was a lot of fun, but it was something that that I nevertheless enjoyed doing. But as you're saying, a lot of the time of the department, a lot of the time of the defense forces then was taken up with the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And of course, those two conflicts, like with so many Australians and Americans and others, those two conflicts pretty much dominated the second half of my working life. So with Iraq and Afghanistan, and indeed Pakistan, I would travel there in those days twice a year. Maybe I did that for 10 years or more. Obviously made a lot of friends, made a lot of contacts. It was fascinating. It was worrying. And I've got to say that I have some regrets about that time and those conflicts. And especially about the policies that we, and I mean the plural we, you know, all of us, follow. Right. And you know this, I talk to many American intelligence officials and defense officials and diplomats over the years who, of course, shared those concerns with me at the time.
Yeah, including me. So, Nick, how did you end up as the head of Australia's Secret Intelligence Service?
So, look, it's not all that unusual for a former diplomat to head Australia's Secret Intelligence Service. My predecessor, who you also know, David Irvin, had done the same thing. In fact, he and I had both been high commissioners or ambassadors, if you like, in Papua New Guinea beforehand. But I also had by that time 15 years of experience in a number of intelligence organizations. And I guess this is a bit different to many diplomats. Because of the nature of my postings overseas, Solomon Islands, some time in Iraq looking for an Australian hostage, Bougainville, I had used intelligence operationally to achieve outcomes. So I had both a understanding of the world, which is pretty important if you're involved in or heading up a secret intelligence service, and I had some intelligence background and operational background as well. So I think it was the combination of those three elements that allowed the government, took the government to make the decision to appoint me.
So you loved being the director of ACES, right?
Sure. Why not? Great job. One of the great jobs.
And what makes it so great? And I know the answer to that, but for my listeners.
I think you know as well as I know it. Look, so I did this job for over 8 years. I think that makes me close to one of the longest serving heads of our secret intelligence service. Why did I love it so much? These sorts of agencies attract the best and brightest. So great people with fantastic skill sets, real and broad interests, a dedication to the job, the sort of work these agencies do, ACES did, builds a very strong, close culture. Then there's the great partnerships, you know, including with the Five Eyes, with CIA, with MI6, and a whole bunch of other services around the world. In these jobs, as you know, Michael, better than I do, you can and you do make a real difference, and that real difference can be almost on a daily basis. It's practical, it's hands-on, it's exciting, it's important, there's great camaraderie.
To keep the time in the Iran desert kind of relevant here, you also, when you were the head of ACES, you got into a little trouble with the Philippine president, right? Can you talk about that?
yeah, I did. So there's not much I can say about the context there, apart from one of our former prime ministers has written a little bit about this. So we, Australia, helped the Philippines armed forces and intelligence services when ISIS-affiliated terrorist groups in the southern Philippines took over and held for a long time a city called Marawi. So we provided some pretty significant support. In fact, the Philippines military have described it as game-changing. So I went to the Philippines. I had a long conversation with President Duterte and his national security cabinet. And then at the end, he asked whether I could do his sort of his fist bump for a photograph, and I made the mistake of agreeing to do that. So the next day, I flew back to Australia. I got in a plane, small plane, out of Sydney to fly back to Canberra. It's early in the morning. Sitting next to me was a guy with one of our newspapers. And about a quarter of the front page of the newspaper was a photo of me and President Duterte doing his fist bump. The guy kept turning to me, looking at the photo, trying to work out if this was the same person. So this too was a low light of my career. It didn't go down all that well with my boss, the foreign minister. But in retrospect, I like the story.
Yeah, no, that's great.
So Michael, in retrospect, I shouldn't have agreed to the photo, obviously. we had such a good and important conversation, the president and I just sort of felt I couldn't say no.
So Nick, then you were asked to serve as your country's first Director General of National Intelligence. Is that a similar role to RDNI? How did you think about that job? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So it's very similar to ODNI, but maybe a little bit of context before I get to those similarities. So our intelligence structures, Australia's and the US, they're similar, but they're also different. And I think a useful, an interesting starting point for your listeners is to go back a long time, to go back to 1975, when one of the most important reviews of the Australian intelligence community and its structures was being undertaken over a number of years by a judge called Robert Hope. So this is 1975 in the US. I think, Michael, it's called the Year of Intelligence, with the Church Committee conducting some pretty far-reaching hearings into CIA activities. Not the best of times for the CIA.
Right.
So Hope goes to Washington in the midst of this. Has great access. Vice President Rockefeller sees him, Church sees him, and your CIA director, Wilman Colby, sees him as well. So one day he's sitting in Langley in your headquarters having lunch with Colby, and Colby's got the radio on because James Jesus Angleton is giving evidence to the Church Committee, public evidence. And he said publicly what he had apparently previously told a closed session of the Church Committee. And this is what he said. It is inconceivable that a secret arm, secret intelligence arm of the government should have to comply with all the overt orders of government. Now, that had a important impact on Hope. But what also had an important impact on Hope was the superb work done by the analytical side of CIA. So this visit was crucially important in shaping Hope's view that Australia needed a central intelligence agency, but needed one that would be very different to the CIA, one focused on intelligence assessment and coordination of the community, while leaving collection and covert operations to a separate organization, and with all this clearly defined by missions and by constraints, if you like. So Hope's, this is way back, right, in the mid-70s, Hope's review led in time to the formation of the Office of National Assessments, which had analytical function, but also a very limited coordination mandate. That's not what Hope had wanted. He'd wanted a stronger integration coordination function. But that didn't come until just over 3 years ago, when another review led to the transition of ONA, the Office of National Assessments, to the Office of National Intelligence. And the Office of National Intelligence is pretty much the counterpart with ODNI. Now, ONI is obviously a lot smaller than ODNI. I'd argue we're probably therefore more nimble than you are, or ODNI is. But we do analysis and we do enterprise management, so we do the integration and coordination of Australia's 10 intelligence agencies and entities. Now, if I look back at the formation of ODNI, not always a happy, successful process in those early years.
Right.
But when I look at it now, I think it's gone through an evolutionary process. That is, it takes time to build trust, and it takes time to build the structures, and it takes time to build the processes. Your friend and mine, Jim Clapper, I think, did a brilliant job. Dan Coates, in difficult circumstances, did what he could. And I think, you're really well placed now with Avril Haines following in Jim's footsteps. But the point I'm trying to make is we're at the beginning of an evolutionary process that you've been at now for, I don't know, what is it, 20 years, I guess.
Yeah.
So a lot of similarities, a lot of differences, and we've learned a lot from you, both what works well and what didn't work so well.
So, Nick, let me ask you just one question about the business of intelligence. And I'd love to get you to comment a bit on the relationship between the Australian and the U.S. intelligence communities. Obviously, anybody listening to this conversation between us has figured out already that we've known each other a long time, that we get along well, that we're friends. But could you talk about that a little bit and maybe put it in the broader context of the security relationship between the two countries?
Yeah, well, Michael, you know how close we are, very close. But sure, let's start with the overall relationship between our two countries. And I think they're probably two important pieces of context, of historical context here. Firstly, Australian forces, armed forces, have fought with US forces in every major conflict over the past 100 years. Our former ambassador to the US, Joe Hockey, called this 100 years of mateship, and 100 years of mateship was celebrated by our countries, by our officials, by your president and our prime minister a year or two ago. Secondly, and I think this is important and interesting, 70 years ago this year, this September, Australia, New Zealand and the US signed the ANZUS Treaty. The ANZUS Treaty aims to protect the security of the Pacific. It's a non-binding collective security agreement to cooperate on military matters in the Pacific region. If you like, it's a commitment to come to each other's aid at the worst of times, to consult and to act. That's the context. That's the history of our relationship. Yeah. So we've been working together. We've been fighting together. We've been sharing intelligence together for a very, very long time. And in all of these relationships, you need trust. And I would argue that while the United States may have more important partners, in a sense, than Australia, you don't have a more trusting partner. And I'd argue right. that is the case not only in the broader national security sense, it's also true in the intelligence relationship.
Yeah. So, Nick, I had a whole bunch of additional questions on kind of the substantive issues of the day that we were going to talk about. You know, China at the top of the list, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. You know, having that absolutely fascinating discussion about your career. So, what I would love to do is, you know, maybe a couple months down the road, is to get you back on the program, and we can actually talk about how you see the issues of the day, because I know my listeners would be very interested. But thank you so much for joining us. It's been a great discussion, and I'm sure the many, many listeners we have in Australia will get a kick out of this as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
Michael, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Nick Warner. I'm Micah Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ariana Freeman. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus, starting May 1st.